listening to The Corbett Report. CorbettReport.com.
Welcome back to The Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you are tuned into Questions for Corbett for the month of January 2019, and as I hope you're aware by now, this is the regular series where you send in the questions and I provide the answers. But this month, we're going to do things a little bit differently. This month, instead of a random hodgepodge mixture of questions, I'm going to be answering questions specifically regarding my recently released World War I conspiracy documentary. So if you have not yet gone and seen the World War I conspiracy documentary, or heard it, or read it, please do go to CorbettReport.com/WWI, where you can get the entire documentary, all three parts, in all sorts of formats, audio, visual, or textual, for your downloading pleasure, completely for free, as with all my work. And so I do hope that you go there and use that resource. But if you have already consumed the World War I conspiracy documentary and are thirsty for more information, don't worry. The Corbett Report is here to provide. I have done a number of follow-up episodes regarding this work. So, for example, I've done a Propaganda Watch video talking about dissecting some of the propaganda from the World War I era. I've done a follow-up podcast episode, History is Written by the Winners, talking about how history is written by the winners, specifically looking at the World War I context and how the history of World War I was written by the winners. And I have provided the complete interviews that were conducted with Richard Grove and Jerry Dougherty for that World War I conspiracy documentary that were featured in clips in that documentary. I've provided the full interviews. And, of course, as I hope you will have seen by now, I've done a complete follow-up interview with Jerry Dougherty specifically about prolonging the agony. So lots and lots of information to go through, and this will be another supplement to this series where I answer questions specifically about World War I. So let's get straight into it. We'll go to the comment section of CorbettReport.com for a question from a Corbett Report subscriber, Martin, who writes, "Dear James, thank you very much for this excellent work. Looking forward to more. There is one point that does not make complete sense. Cecil Rhodes, Stead, and the early secret elite dream of an Anglo-Saxon brotherhood slash British world dominance did not turn into reality. After World War I, the British Empire had lost its position as the world's dominant power. It was indebted to the USA, a far more powerful rival than Germany could ever have been. After World War II, which according to Churchill and De Gaulle was merely a continuation of World War I, the British Empire was finished. And now, in the 21st century, the Anglo-Saxon countries are ruined and culturally terminally ill. Can it be that Cecil Rhodes and the British imperialists served as useful idiots for the advancement of an entirely different goal, the creation of state power for the international bankers, the Rothschilds, Schiffs, Warburgs, etc.? All along, these bankers had the money to buy a king or a government, but were still dependent on those being corrupt enough to be bought. The creation of a Zionist national state was to change that and to give them military power. World War I allotted Palestine to the Zionists, and World War II resulted in the creation of Israel. Ever since, Israel gets supported and receives unparalleled concessions from Zionists all over the world. Nuclear weapons technology, impunity for crimes against humanity, trade privileges, special payments, free submarines, etc. Which state is at the top of the international pecking order? The US, Britain, or Israel? To all those already crying anti-Semitism, I would like to point out that most Jews have been used as cannon fodder all along, and many Israelis are just being used as dispensable chess figures as anyone else." Okay, thank you for the question, Martin. I think there are a few different layers that we have to dissect here in order to come to a fuller understanding of the question, let alone the answer. And I think the first thing that we should address is the notion that I understand is very tempting from our post-war perspective, the notion that, well, if there was this secret elite that was engineering things towards this certain goal, then World War I was the plan, or at least the culmination of their plan. It was what they were striving towards. It was what was going to deliver them, supposedly, this world order they had envisioned, and clearly it didn't do so, so they were a failure. Well, I think that misreads things, at least on the level of thinking that World War I was the plan, or even the culmination of the plan, any more than saying that the Rhodes-Milner secret society clique plan was the Boer War, which they also, as I go through in the documentary, did admit to starting. So they that was clearly part of things that they were involved in. So was that the plan? No, World War One was not the plan. It was not some event that was set in stone. We're going in 1914, we're going to start a world war, and it's going to last 4 years, and we're going to get this and that. It was an event that, in their eyes, in the eyes of the secret elite that was engineering various events, it became necessary to achieve certain goals. In this case, I think quite specifically, in the easiest part of that to understand is to crush the upstart German nation, which was a rising threat to the British Empire. And this is no conspiracy history. This is something that was widely known and understood and talked about in great detail even before the war happened, the growing rivalry between Germany and Britain. So I think that's one aspect of this. World War One was not the plan of this group. It was just something that became necessary in their eyes towards the goal of achieving their ultimate ends. But secondly, I think the other thing, another thing that we need to look at is your formulation of that as the Anglo-Saxon Brotherhood / British World Dominance. That was not the ultimate end point that this group wanted to achieve. Even Cecil Rhodes wrote about how he wanted an Anglo-American establishment order that would... he wrote, for example, about the World Parliament that he wanted that would convene for 4 years in Washington and 4 years in London, or whatever crazy scheme he had in mind. But clearly it was an Anglo-American order. He was, at that time, as it being in late 19th century England in the British Empire, and feeling the loss of the greatness of the British Empire, it was perhaps at its zenith, but clearly there were signs that it was not going to attain that or retain that for in perpetuity. And feeling the rise of all of these competitors, I think clearly Rhodes and others saw that the Anglo-Saxon bread was going to be buttered by reclaiming America in some way. And, you know, who would have the upper hand in that relationship is a different thing. But at any rate, it relied on not a British world dominance so much as an Anglo-American order. That was even specifically talked about by Rhodes himself. But as I say, after he died and that group was subsumed by Milner and his acolytes, I think even more so that shift happened away from the idea of the British English dominance towards an Anglo-American order. So from that perspective, it's quite clear that this group was enormously successful in achieving its aims. The entire 20th century is a testament to that. The rise of the Anglo-American and then the Anglo-American world order. At any rate, it's the same thing. And I think it's quite clear that still the banking establishment is roosted in the city of London. That is an exceptionally important part of the world order that we're living in right now. And I'll point you to a recent documentary, the name of which escapes me at the moment, but anyway, Brock will show it on screen, and I'll put it in the show notes for this Questions for Corbett, talking about the rule of the city of London and the banking establishment there. So I think there is still an Anglo-American order that exists, and the Anglo side of it is certainly downplayed militarily and geopolitically, but is still there financially, and the American side of it is clearly the military / geopolitical gorilla elephant in the room. Just for more of a sense of what World War One really did accomplish for this particular clique and its goals, we can turn to even relatively mainline history, Niall Ferguson's The Pity of War, for a pretty powerful summary of the objectives that were actually achieved by World War One. So reading from The Pity of War, quote, "What, if anything, was achieved by this Armageddon? Belgium and northern France were cleared of German troops. So were Romania, Poland, the Ukraine, and the Baltic states. The German, Russian, and Turkish empires were diminished, the Austrian altogether destroyed. Hungary shrank, so too did Bulgaria, and Great Britain, which by stages lost most of Ireland. New states were formed. Austria and Hungary went their separate ways. The Serbs achieved their goal of a South Slav state, called, after 1929, Yugoslavia, along with the Croats and Slovenes, as well as the Bosnian Muslims. Czechoslovakia, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Finland became independent. Italy grew, though less than her leaders had hoped, acquiring the South Tyrol, Istria, part of Dalmatia, and the Dodecanese Islands in 1923. France reclaimed Alsace and Lorraine, lost in 1871. She and Britain also enlarged their colonial empires in the form of mandates of former enemy possessions, Syria and Lebanon for France, Iraq and Palestine for Britain, who had committed herself to the creation of a Jewish national home in the latter. Cameroon and Togoland were also shared between the two victors. In addition, German Southwest Africa went to South Africa, German Samoa to New Zealand, and German New Guinea to Australia. Britain also snapped up German East Africa, to Belgian and Portuguese chagrin. They were fobbed off with less desirable African territory. Sassoon had been right after all in July 1917. It had become a war of conquest. The map, as Balfour said, had yet more red on it, i.e. more British Empire on it. In the British War Cabinet's concluding meeting before the Versailles Conference, Edwin Montagu had commented dryly that he would like to hear some arguments against Britain's annexing the whole world. America, however, rivaled Britain as the world's banker. It stood on the brink of global economic supremacy, and President Wilson's vision of a new world order based on a League of Nations and international law was realized, if not quite in the utopian form of his dreams. Okay, we'll end the quote there. It does go on from there, but I think that does give a sense that much was achieved by World War I, including for the British Empire itself, let alone for the greater vision of that Anglo-American world order, which clearly was cemented into place as the world hegemon by the end of World War I, and even more clearly by the end of World War II. But so all of that is to say, I don't think this was a loss. And I don't think that the people who were involved, like the Milner group, for example, and his acolytes and people surrounding Milner's orbit, were losers in this by any means. They achieved much from World War I. But I think that this leads us into the next layer of answer to your question, which is the idea that is so tempting, and I understand the temptation, but it ultimately leads towards cartoon history, the idea that an event like World War I all happened because one clique desired one aim for one particular set of reasons. I understand how tempting that is. It would be so easy if I could just say, World War I was this, and that's all you need to understand, and now let's move on to the next lesson in history. World War II was this, and then this. And it would be so wonderful to be able to summarize decades and, you know, the loss of tens of millions of lives with a single sentence in a single way. It does not work like that. As I've stressed time and time again, and will continue to do so until I think people really start picking up on it, deep events, large-scale events, world-changing events, like a 9/11, like a JFK, like a World War I, an entire global war, do not happen because one particular clique desires it for one particular reason, and everything is about that. That's too simplistic, and does not do a service to history. So the idea that, first of all, the World War I conspiracy, I hope people realize this isn't about this one group that did it for one thing. In fact, the group that I say is the driving force behind the embroiling of England and eventually America into the war is not even a group, as I stress in the documentary. I mean, it's been called different things, but there is no card-carrying membership that people had to the Milner Group or the Round Table or Rhodes Secret Society or whatever you want to call it. This was a loose association that did include certain people who were very key, clear drivers in this story, like Alfred Milner. But there were many people associated loosely who may or may not have had any idea that such an association really existed, but you can kind of pick up on it in certain ways. Also thinking in the context of a different mainline history book, The Sleepwalkers by Christopher Clark, he does a good job of showing how the British Foreign Office operated in that time when Edward Grey took over in 1906 and started preparing, really laying the groundwork towards war with Germany. It was it was the case where people would be filing reports for the Home Office, and reports that showed how perfidious and evil the Germans were and how warmongering and how they must be confronted, those reports would be, this is a fantastic report, this is great, excellent work, we must do this. And anyone who had a counter-narrative that wasn't so viciously anti-German, this is poor work, shoddy. In that sense, you foster an environment where people are working towards a goal that they don't even necessarily know about themselves. They don't know there is a group that is planning this and thinking about this. They just know, if I write this, I get commended, I get promoted, I get accolades. If I write this, my career basically goes in the toilet. People, again, don't necessarily need to be told and drawn into a smoky room and made part of a, and take a blood oath to some secret society. They just know which side their bread is buttered on and they can be led along. So that's one of the aspects of this. The other way I think we have to get a broader handle on this is, this is essentially, when we're looking at a world war with all of these different nations and empires and royalty and all of this involved in this gigantic conflict, we are looking at, it's been likened to it many times, but I think it's a good analogy, the warring mafia factions that occasionally you have the scene, I harken back to my childhood in the Hollywood programming, Dick Tracy, where the mafia gets together and they decide, okay, we're going to put aside our differences for right now, we're not going to kill each other in this room, but hey, wouldn't it all be good if we all worked together to get Dick Tracy, or whatever the case may be. All of us have different perspectives and agendas, and we all want different things, but hey, it would be good for all of us if this thing happened. That's the way that we can look at an event like a 9/11 or a JFK or a World War I. It's not one tiny group that's doing it for one purpose and one purpose only. It's a number of players can be drawn to the table because there is something in it for them. And something quite really in it for them. Not just necessarily an airy-fairy promise that doesn't materialize. For the winners, it clearly materializes. For the losers, not so much. But everyone is drawn to the table for different reasons. So saying that it was the Zionists that did World War I to get the Balfour Declaration is, again, a cartoon reading of history. And one that I find particularly funny because it plays directly into Zionist propaganda. As I pointed out, if you go to Balfour100.com, you can actually see the Balfour Declaration, and you can see all of the drafts and revisions. The Lord Rothschild draft that kicked things off in July 1917, and then going to Arthur Balfour, then going to Alfred Milner, then there was the Milner-Amory draft, which became the Balfour Declaration that was handed back to Rothschild. So you can see the development of this is a carefully worded document, and the actual wording, of course, as I'm sure you all know, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, which means, precisely in legal terms, nothing. Absolutely nothing. This is not saying creation of a state, a nation state, a Jewish national home, or a national home for the Jewish people, I should say, in Palestine. Now, one thing, of course, as I'm sure everyone is aware, at that time that this document was passed, it was not a British mandate at all. So Britain had no interest in authority over ability to say anything about Palestine at the time this document actually was issued, which is one of the things we have to keep in mind. So it had no legal force in that sense. And also, the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people, again, does not mean anything. It does not mean the creation of a state. A national home for the Jewish people really, literally could mean anything. Just a community that lives within the state of Palestine, which could function as a separate state. That's one of the interpretations. And again, we have to understand this was a carefully worded document that went back and forth over many drafts so that they would arrive at this legally meaningless jumble of words that, of course, in